Persigo Press presents the Henry Rios Mysteries podcast. Hello, this is Michael Nava, author of a series of crime novels featuring Henry Rios, a gay Mexican-American criminal defense lawyer, and the producer of this podcast. Today we present Lay Your Sleeping Head, the first novel in the series. Lay Your Sleeping Head opens in the summer of 1982 in the fictional town of Linden, California, 30 miles south of San Francisco. Linden is the home of the prestigious university of the same name, founded in the 19th century by railroad tycoon Grover Linden. Henry Rios is a public defender, born and raised in a small town in California's Central Valley and from a working-class Mexican-American family. He is a graduate of Linden University and its top-ranked law school. In 1982, there is no internet. People smoke in bars and on airplanes. Most gay men are closeted, and no one has heard of AIDS. It's an America where 83% of the people identify as white, 85% as Christian, and 83% say that homosexuality is morally wrong. Ronald Wilson Reagan, who once declared that trees cause more pollution than automobiles, is the President of the United States. In this episode, the appearance of Hugh's great-uncle John Smith seems to resolve once and for all the mystery of Hugh's death.
Are you sure it was the same guy?
I'm sure, Freddie. Peter Barron was the man I saw running out of Aaron's house the night he was shot.
You told me you only saw the guy for a few seconds before he beamed you with his gun.
Young and white with a mustache, remember?
Young and white with a mustache? That describes most of the police force. It's not enough for an arrest.
It was him. I'd swear to it. And since when is an eyewitness identification not enough for an arrest?
It was dark. You were dazed. You saw him for what, 5, 10 seconds? You know better than me. Any half-decent defense lawyer could take your identification apart. Plus, I looked into Barron's background. He's an ex-military, a decorated Vietnam vet.
What about the fact that he was one of the men who kidnapped me in the city?
Your voice ID is even weaker than your visual ID. Anyway, unless we can make a connection, the mugging is irrelevant to Gold's murder. Not to mention it didn't even happen in my jurisdiction.
My apartment was tossed by whoever kidnapped me. That did happen in your jurisdiction.
You want to blame Barron for that too? Putting aside a shaky ID, you've got an even bigger problem here. Your whole theory is that Judge Paris was behind these murders. Barron works for John Smith. Why would he be doing the judge's dirty work?
I don't know. Ask him after you arrest him.
I'm not going to arrest him. Not on what you've given me.
So he walks.
I'll invite him down here for a little talk. That's the best I can do.
I want to be here for that.
No way. You're a potential witness. It's time for you to butt out. Got it?
Whatever you say, Winifred.
I mean it, Henry. Time for you to stop playing Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes? Nah, I see myself more as Miss Marple. Hello?
It's Patterson. Barron's in the wind and Smith wants a meeting.
What?
After you and I talked, I called Barron's office to arrange a meeting. I was told he was in Japan on business. He was supposed to have returned a week ago Friday. When I called back, I was referred to John Smith's lawyer. He told me Barron's disappeared. When I told him why I wanted to talk to Barron, he said he'd get back to me. He called this morning and told me Smith wants to make a statement about Barron. I figure you've earned the right to be there, Miss Marple. Orms will pick you up at 2.
Pick me up? Where are we going?
Smith's place, the Linden Mansion, on the top of Knob Hill.
Look at this place, Henry. It's a castle.
Well, Grover Linden was a robber baron, so he would have lived in a castle. Freddy's waiting for us at the door.
You're late.
10 minutes, Freddy.
Yeah, well, you don't keep people like John Smith waiting. Remember, Henry, you're here as a courtesy, so keep your mouth shut.
Good afternoon.
I'm Freddy Patterson from the Santa Clara District Attorney's Office. This is Detective Orms and Mr. Rios. Mr. Smith is expecting us.
Yes, he'll receive you in the library.
We stepped into a long, dim hallway lit by wall sconces carved with oak leaves and stalks of wheat. The walls were covered with medieval tapestries and lined with Victorian chairs, tables, and cabinets that seemed to serve no other purpose than to take up space. I remember Hugh's comment that his uncle lived in a mausoleum, and this place did have the air of a beautifully decorated tomb. The library was lined with floor-to-ceiling bookshelves crammed with leather-bound books. Above the fireplace, a life-size portrait of Grover Linden stared down at us, and from his expression, he wasn't liking what he saw. We stood around for a moment, talking in whispers like we were in church, when the door opened and two men entered. One of them was short and stout, with white hair curling over his shirt collar. He wore the uniform of a $300-an-hour lawyer, gray, chalk-striped suit, rep tie, gold cufflinks. The other man, the elder of the two, was tall and thin and white-haired. He was dressed in khakis, a white shirt, an old blue blazer, and carpet slippers. He glanced at me with eyes that were the same color as Hugh's and allowed himself a tiny smile. The lawyer cleared his throat and began to talk.
"I'm William Caldwell, Mr. Smith's lawyer. Thank you for coming. Mr. Smith wants to make a statement regarding his former employee, Peter Barron."
"Former?"
"Please, let me continue. As soon as Miss Patterson informed me that she wanted to talk to Barron about the shooting in Linden, we ordered him to return from Japan to answer her questions. As you know, however, Mr. Barron did not return, and his present whereabouts are unknown."
"You have no idea where he is?"
"I'm afraid not. Mr. Barron served as an intelligence officer during the Vietnam War. We assume he retained some contacts in Southeast Asia. It wouldn't be hard for him to disappear."
"In my line of business, flight shows consciousness of guilt."
"Well, you're not wrong, Miss Patterson. We conducted our own investigation, and we now believe that Barron and another man, Aaron Gold, murdered Mr. Smith's grandnephew, Hugh Paris. Barron and Gold then had a falling out that resulted in Barron killing Gold."
"Bullshit. Aaron's not a murderer."
"Henry, get a hold of yourself. Mr. Caldwell, why would these men have killed Hugh Paris? Didn't Barron work for Mr. Smith?"
"A few months ago, Hugh came to Mr. Smith with some rather incendiary charges against his grandfather. He alleged that Judge Paris sexually abused him when he was a boy. He wanted compensation from the judge and asked Mr. Smith for his help. Mr. Smith assigned Mr. Barron to look into the matter. This involved questioning some of the judge's associates. When the judge learned about our investigation, he had Mr. Gold, his lawyer, approach Barron and offer him $2 million to terminate the investigation."
"Terminate meaning murder Hugh?"
"What the judge intended cannot be established since he's no longer with us. But what followed is that Barron and Gold killed Hugh. So you can draw your own conclusions."
"You're saying Barron went rogue, and Mr. Smith here knew nothing about his involvement in Hugh's death?"
"That is exactly what I'm saying. Mr. Smith was devastated by Hugh's death, so much so that he ordered Barron to investigate it. Of course, Barron reported back that Hugh's death was accidental."
"Why did Barron kill Gold?"
"Obviously, we can't know for certain without questioning Barron. They may have quarreled over money, or perhaps Mr. Gold's conscience got the better of him and he wanted to turn himself in. Whatever the reason, Barron decided he had to eliminate his accomplice."
"You have proof of this, Mr. Caldwell?"
"Our evidence is circumstantial. Records of phone calls and bank deposits and so forth. Some of it is inferential and even conjectural, but we are sure of the basic facts. Gold suborned Barron, and together they killed Hugh, after which they had a falling out, and Barron killed Gold. Of course, we'll turn over everything we have to your office, Miss Patterson, so that you can prosecute Barron when and if he is apprehended. That's all Mr. Smith has to say."
Pardon me, but Mr. Smith hasn't actually said anything."
"You're Henry, aren't you? Hugh's friend."
"Yes."
"He spoke of you often. If there's anything I can ever do for you, Mr. Rios, you must let me know. You can reach me through Caldwell, but for now, you must excuse me. Good afternoon."
"You haven't said a word since we left the city."
What are you thinking, Henry?
I can't believe Aaron was involved in Hugh's murder.
Well, we always thought two people were involved. One to drive Hugh to campus and inject him, the other to drive the getaway car. And you said that Gold was keeping things from you.
Yeah, but just... not that.
Look, Henry, my money is on Baron as the killer. Gold may not even have known what he was planning. Maybe he thought Baron would just rough Hugh up.
That really doesn't make me feel any better. Caldwell said Hugh told Smith about the sexual abuse, but he didn't say that Hugh told Smith he thought the judge had murdered his wife and son.
Maybe Hugh didn't tell him.
No. He specifically told me he talked to Smith about it, and Smith didn't believe him.
Then that's why Caldwell didn't mention it. Henry, you got your answer to who killed Hugh. I know it's not the answer you wanted, but the case is closed.
Not as long as Baron is out there.
Not much we can do unless he tries to come back to the U.S. But I'll personally make sure there's an arrest warrant out on him and notify the FBI and Interpol. More than that...
I know. It's out of your hands. Thanks, Terry. Thanks for everything.
Hey, you're the one who figured it out. You'd make a good cop.
God forbid. Grant.
Can I come in? I brought you peaches.
Yeah, come in. Why peaches?
The flowers seemed too corny, and I didn't know what else to bring to apologize. Then I saw these peaches. They smelled nice, and... Listen, I'm an idiot, Henry. I was wrong about Peter Baron and the things I said to you at the restaurant.
Shut up and kiss me. I missed you.
I missed you too.
I was about to head over to Aaron's. His parents are coming up from LA to close up his house, and his sister called and asked me if I could clean it up before they arrived.
Clean it up? Oh. You mean there's blood and stuff where he was shot?
Yeah. His mom and dad don't need to see that.
Well, let me come help.
It won't be pleasant.
That's all the more reason I should come with you.
We can take my car.
Oh, it's cold in here. Why is this black dust everywhere?
Fingerprint powder.
The armchair. Those stains. This is where he was shot.
Yeah. We've got to get rid of the chair before his folks arrive. Damn, it's not going to fit in my car.
We passed a U-Haul place on our way over. Why don't I go back and rent a van while you start cleaning up?
Good idea. The sooner we get the armchair out of here, the easier it will be to deal with the rest of the place.
I'll be back in a flash.
I cleared a space around the chair so we could get it out of there when he returned. I lifted up the top of the ottoman to move it, and to my surprise, the top came off, revealing a compartment. Inside the compartment was a large envelope. My name was written on it. Inside the envelope was a thick document captioned "Amendment." I flipped through the pages, uncertain of what I was looking at until I came to the last page where there were two signatures, John Lyndon Smith and Robert Prescott Paris. Below the signature was a date 15 years earlier and the notary public stamp. I turned back to the first page and began reading. When I finished, I tucked it away in my coat and I didn't mention it to Grant when he came back. There was someone I had to talk to first.
You're back, young Henry. Are you looking for more free legal advice?
I have a document I'd like you to read and explain to me.
Let's have it. Where did you get this?
From an attorney at the firm that represented Judge Paris.
I'm not sure I approve. Give me a few minutes. My eyesight's not what it used to be. Extraordinary. Unbelievable. What do you want to know?
All I remember about trust is what I learned in your class, so I'm not sure I understand this document correctly.
What's your understanding of it?
I think it amends the Linden Trust to strip Judge Paris of pretty much all of his authority as trustee in favor of John Smith. Can that be right?
Yes. And it turned Bob into a mere figurehead with no power at all.
From what I know of Judge Paris, it doesn't seem like the sort of thing he would have agreed to.
Oh, you don't know the half of it. When Grover Linden died, he left the bulk of his fortune to the Linden Trust. The income from that trust was to support the university. He specified that there would be only two trustees and that they must be his lineal descendants or descendants by marriage. The trustees are required to meet annually with the president of the university to discuss the school's funding needs, but they were given unfettered discretion in deciding which projects to fund. The only restraint on their authority was Linden's command that the income be spent to elevate the university to the first rank of educational institutions in the world. Grover Linden wanted to assure his legacy would be preserved and extended by his family. Bob Paris wanted in on that. He tried to persuade his wife and brother-in-law to amend the trust and add a third trustee, but John Smith utterly refused and shut him out.
But then Christina and Jeremy Paris were killed. Once they were gone, the only remaining lineal descendants of Grover Linden were Hugh, who was a child, and his dad, who was insane. That cleared the way for the judge to get appointed as trustee. Is that what all this was about? He killed his wife and son so he could run the trust? That's crazy.
Is it? Think about the kind of power the Linden trustees have. The power to found graduate schools, hire world-famous architects to construct iconic buildings, start great archival and art collections, fund groundbreaking medical research at a state-of-the-art hospital, provide seed money for a presidential library, endow chairs and prizes and a press. Building a transcontinental railroad is all good and well, but creating one of the world's great universities, that's the modern equivalent of building a pyramid. An eternal monument. I'm sure if Bob had his way, he would have plastered his name all over campus.
But this amendment to the trust, it stripped him of that power.
Yeah. And this gets us back to your question. What would have induced a megalomaniac like Bob Paris to agree to this humiliating document?
Only one thing I can think of. He was blackmailed.
You've been listening to Lay Your Sleeping Head, a Henry Rios mystery. If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the word on social media. We depend upon your support to keep this series going. For updates and behind-the-scene extras, visit us at our Facebook page, The Henry Rios Mysteries, or at michaelnavawriter.com under the podcast tab. We'd also love to hear from you. Message us on Facebook or email us at persigopress@gmail.com. That's persigopress@gmail.com. This is an abridged version of the novel, Lay Your Sleeping Head. You can buy the complete novel at Amazon. For this episode, our cast was Armando Rey as Henry Rios, Scarlett Hepworth as Detective Terry Orms, Debbie Durst as D.A. Freddie Patterson, Dean Larson as William Caldwell, Bobby Singer as John Smith, and Stuart Slater as Professor Howard. Our director is Russell Kaltschmidt. Our sound engineer is Dave Peck. Music and sound effects were composed by Josh DeRosa. The episode was written and produced by Michael Nava. Thank you for listening.